Mr. Stephen Wolfram, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
When it comes to these more advanced AIs, there are sort of these two big categories of tasks, right, that they can help with. One is solving very specific and well-defined problems, such as those involving maths, right, when it's not something computationally irreducible. And this is something that the collaboration between Wolfram Alpha and ChatGPT might be very helpful. And the other one is the task of tackling larger issues, right, that generate reusable solutions, like programming systems, for instance. So how do you see what the advancements in AI may bring for these two situations? What sort of direction might they take?
Well, I think, you know, what do the current developments in AI, what are they providing for us? I mean, the big surprise to everyone was the success of large language models about a year and a half ago now. And the fact that an AI can generate kind of text that's kind of like what a human might write, and maybe a little bit of code that's like what a human might write. I think the main thing we learned from that is that generating language is perhaps not as difficult as we thought it was. What the AI has done is it's found certain regularities of language, which we might have found thousands of years ago, but we didn't. Now the AI has kind of shown from its sort of analysis and effect of all that content that we humans have put out on the web and elsewhere, has found these regularities, which it can use to generate language that seems kind of human-like to us. Now, how does that relate to when it's doing that? It's kind of producing reasonable human language. That's very different from saying, I'm going to get the exact right answer to a math problem, or I'm going to write the exact right piece of computer code that's going to do this sophisticated thing. And the way that kind of large language models and so on work, it's really good at doing these kind of not so sort of shallow human-like things, and really unsuitable in its current form for doing these kind of deep computational tasks. And I think the thing that is pretty neat for us is, you know, I've spent the last 40-something years building this kind of computational language to represent the world computationally, to kind of have a sort of computational formalism for describing the world in a precise way that then we can compute from and do deep computations with it. And so the big interest right now is to connect large language models, which provide kind of a linguistic interface to things, with our ability to sort of do deep computation. And it was really convenient that in Wolfram Alpha, 15 years ago, we built natural language interface to that. So the LLM can produce natural language, and the natural language it can produce is immediately understandable to Wolfram Alpha. The way Wolfram Alpha works is it's converting natural language to our computational language, Wolfram language, from which it can then do precise computations. And so the typical workflow is human might be just sort of chatting with the LLM and kind of trying to formulate what they want to say just in pure conversation. And the LLM is trying to say, well, let's try and make that more precise. Let's try and formulate that in the way that Wolfram Alpha can understand, Wolfram Language can understand. And once it's done that, it can then try running that in our computational language in Wolfram Alpha and see what happens. Maybe it'll work. Maybe the thing that it does is the thing you actually meant to do. And so kind of the best sort of interface, I think, that we first had a version of this more than a year ago now, but that we've been steadily refining, is something where kind of it's chatting with the LLM, and then there's this kind of box of precise stuff where you see, and the important thing is you see both the input and the output in that box. You see both what the LLM said to Wolfram Alpha or said to Wolfram Language, and then you see the kind of the sort of correct computation from that input. And so I think the typical kind of pattern will be, already is for at least our internal people and a few outside people, is that you're chatting with the LLM and you're trying to sort of crispen up your thoughts so that it can get to the point where it can write precise computational language code. You then can see that that's, oh yes, that's what I wanted. Then you can take that as a kind of brick that you can use to build a big tower of capabilities. And, you know, we're in the sort of very unique position of being able to do this because our computational language, first of all, it sort of talks about the world. And second of all, it can describe cities and geo-coordinates and chemicals and all these kinds of things. And second of all, it's a language that from the beginning was intended to be read by humans as well as written by humans. I mean, typical programming languages are human writes it, computer runs it, so to speak. It's not intended as something which is kind of a way of sort of formulating one's own thoughts in a formal way. I mean, mathematical notation, for example, has always had that characteristic. It's written by humans for humans, so to speak. In our computational language is intended to be written, well, usually by humans, for humans and computers. Now there's an additional piece to that, which is it can be written by computers. It can be written by AIs for humans and for computers, so to speak. So that's a pretty interesting kind of development there. I think in terms of what we'll see, I mean, this is a thing that's evolving even by the day. What's possible, what really works, what kind of models one can use, can it be a local model eventually? To what extent can one, in the current way things are set up, it's kind of you do a lot of LLM interaction, and then the LLM says, okay, now I need to use a tool and figure out something computationally. It's fairly coarse-grained at that level. What we've been doing is working towards sort of finer and finer grained versions of that type of interaction, both by fine-tuning and prompting the LLM, by getting sort of inside the mechanism of how it's all working, and by having the right kinds of tooling on the sort of computational side to be able to pick up what the LLM is doing and respond to it in a computational kind of way. So I think as I say, it's literally evolving by the day. And in fact, just today, I saw some great demos that our team has put together of various things to do with sort of code, in a sense, directed code writing. And I think it's very hard to know where it's going to end up because nobody really understands in detail how LLMs work. Just, it's a bit like brains. We know how the individual neurons work, but how that all comes together to make brains that do all the things brains do, been hard to figure out. We get to do kind of artificial neuroscience on LLMs. It's a lot easier to do those experiments than it is with real brains, but still, it's very hard to tell what's going on. And I think this the sort of knowing and people seem to have the view that, okay, ChatGPT did much more than anybody expected. Therefore, let's extrapolate from that and assume that over time, AIs will just become able to do every possible thing that we might have ever imagined they would be able to do. That has not been the history of this technology. I don't think it's what's going to happen now. To know that for sure, we have to understand better what LLMs are really doing, although I think we do have some understanding of that now. But, if you look at the history of neural nets, it's kind of, like I first worked on neural nets back in 1981, and I couldn't get neural nets to do anything interesting. And what I didn't know was what the world kind of learned in 2011, which is, turns out if you bash a neural net hard enough, it will learn lots of things. What I assumed was back in 1981, I give the neural net some fairly simple tasks. I try and get it to learn how to do them. It doesn't really succeed. Oh, it can't do those simple tasks. I tried fairly hard. It's not going to work. Two things that I think people missed. Turns out it's easier to do harder tasks, and bashing it really, really hard can eventually succeed. And in fact, I have a project right now that has to do with answering the question, why does machine learning work? Why is it possible to, when you bash it hard enough that it actually learns? Because not obvious that would happen. It could be the case that the thing would just do, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this. It could never get to the point where it can distinguish cats from dogs or something like that. Or it just can't intrinsically do that, or you can't train it to do that, even though it could in principle do it. Both of those things, it's sort of mysterious how that works. I mean, interestingly enough, and this is stuff I'm working on right now, the problem is very similar to the problem of biological evolution. It's not obvious why biological evolution should work. That is, you make these little, mutations to the genome and so on. Why will that get you from the little single-celled organism to us and so on? It's not obvious you can get there. It's a similar problem to the problem of machine learning. It's actually quite technically similar as well. And I think I'm slowly getting a bit of an understanding of why it works. It's kind of a fairly deep piece of science, why this stuff works. I don't know if we want to get into that here, but this is kind of my and once we know why it works, The reason that's pretty interesting is because then we know how much of all of the detail of neural networks and, the precise precision of the numbers you use and all this kind of thing, how much matters and how much is irrelevant, how much is part of the core phenomenon of machine learning, and how much of it is just, the details of the particular implementation that we have now.
Well, fantastic. Thank you very much for your answer, Mr. Wolfram. And going into another question right now, I mean, you talk a lot about how things work, and I read your article slash book, What is ChatGPT Doing and Why Does It Work? I loved it. And I mean, I have it in my Kindle. I read it like multiple times. And I used it even as a resource when I was writing my book about AI. But my question here is, you mentioned like ChatGPT, you mentioned how you are and your team are trying to connect it with Wolfram Alpha, with Wolfram Language, and to do more things in the future. But there are many models, like you mentioned as well, like Claude, there's Llama from Meta, there's Google Gemini. And there's this difference between the private models and the open source models. Do you think the future is open source or private?
Well, I mean, that's as much a business question as it is a technical question. I can say that in our company, we're running basically all of the models. We have, practically every day, there's some new model added that connects to Wolfram Language. And we have kind of a leaderboard of how, because we actually have tasks like doing mathematical calculations and writing computational language code, because we have tasks where there are definite right answers. I mean, although it's tricky, I mean, both in math and in code writing, it's like what counts as the right answer? Because if you're doing algebra, for instance, there may be different forms of an algebraic expression, they all count as right. If you're doing code, there may be different pieces of code which, yes, do or don't actually compute the same thing and so on. So it's tricky, but for different reasons, we've solved the problem of doing kind of code equivalency testing, math equivalency testing, and so on. We've solved these problems actually for the work that we've done for EdTech, for people doing education and wanting humans to give answers and rating those human answers. Well, now we can use what we've done on rating human answers to rate AI answers. And we've been doing that. And so we have pretty detailed information on sort of what's doing, how are these models doing? I think a couple of things to say about that. I don't think there's a fundamental reason that, the open source models will do worse than the other models. I think that there's sort of this trade-off. How big a model do you want? How good do you want the performance to be? A thing that we've just been really seeing, even with things like code writing, is that being able to use a vector database, a RAG or whatever, in the middle of, as a tool, as the LLM runs, being able to call our computational system as a tool when the LLM runs, these are providing an important kind of leg up for much weaker models to really perform quite well. So it's, I mean, as of today, we were finding that a bunch of models enhanced by those kinds of techniques that are models that could actually be run locally on a realistic end user machine are able to, it seems, do fairly well at the tasks that we want them to do, comparable to the way unaided, top of the line models are doing. So it is an interesting thing. I give an analogy with humans. Okay, so I've been a sort of scientist for a long time, and I used to do physics back when I was. I do physics now as well, but I did physics starting off when I was a kid. And doing physics, a lot of what's involved is doing complicated calculations, which I was never very good at. Except that when I was like a mid-teenager, I made the meta discovery that you could use tools to do those calculations, namely computers. And me plus my computer was really pretty good, as doing those kinds of physics calculations and so on. Me without those tools was pretty crummy. But it's sort of the same thing with the LLMs. Even an LLM that isn't so sophisticated with tools can do really well. The challenge is getting the LLM to correctly call those tools. And that's the thing that I think is, it's a sort of technical problem that is getting progressively solved. It would really help if we understood better how LLMs really work. That would really help in making that interface. But you see, there are a lot of things in terms of, for example, code writing, there are a lot of things that LLMs can deal with that humans don't find it so easy to deal with. For example, you generate a piece of code, you run the code. In our system, it we have a version that runs for LLMs where when something goes wrong, it's generating all this telemetry about what happened. A human would just look at it and glaze over and say, you know, that's really too detailed, I don't care. But the LLM happily goes through and reads all that stuff. And that gives it a huge clue about what went wrong. And then you see it routinely go back and say, oh, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. You know, let me fix this. And it will iterate many times often. And the end result is often, yes, it got it right. So that's a, you know, I think we're only part way, I think, in understanding kind of how to make use of LLMs in the best possible way. I mean, I kind of view it as being, it's a little bit like the domestication of animals back early in the history of our species, so to speak. You know, we knew that there was an ox and it could do something useful, but, you know, can we figure out how you train the ox or whatever? I'm not sure whether oxes are trainable, but that's kind of the situation that we're in. And, you know, I think in terms of the kind of the landscape, the technology landscape, you know, the main ideas of LLMs are at this point fairly well known. There are details, there's good engineering, there's not so good engineering, there's large amounts of effort in, you know, reinforcement learning, human feedback type stuff, there's better training sets, there's a lot of detailed hard work to be done in making a good LLM, but it's not as if sort of the core ideas aren't out there. And my assumption is that sort of you will come to just expect a basically competent LLM to be available to you. It's kind of in the design of computer systems, there have been these different assumptions you can make. I mean, it's like, can you assume you're always connected to the internet? At some point you can assume that. You know, in the past, you were like, oh, well, you know, we have to have all this stuff locally and it's got to be downloaded on floppy disks or something because we're not connected to the internet. But, you know, there are these times where you can start assuming things. And I think what the place where there's sort of the most mileage to be got with LLMs is kind of, you know, how do you find use cases where the strengths of LLMs work well and the weaknesses don't squash them, so to speak? And, you know, the thing to realize, it's a general feature, I guess, of machine learning is if you've got a task where 80% success is a huge win, then machine learning is going to be, you know, a worthwhile approach. If you've got a task where unless you nail it completely, it's worthless, then it's not going to be a good approach. And a lot of these kinds of, you know, we kind of have specialized in doing sort of precise computation where you are doing tasks where you really have to nail it. And that's sort of a different thing from what the LLMs are doing. And I think we're in this very interesting position, which I didn't particularly foresee, that, you know, LLMs are becoming fairly generic. We have this sort of unique computational language and computational knowledge base that, you know, nobody else has really thought to build. And it's taken us about 35 years to build it. And it's been quite kind of hard. You know, we have this kind of unique capability that now is a tool that the LLMs can use to really get to another level of capability. And I don't know, for me, at least that's an exciting thing. But I think that some of the very best use cases, well, there are different kinds of use cases, but one example of a really good use case is to use the LLM to create an artifact that will then be used offline, so to speak, to create that lump of code that you then know, yes, it's the right thing. You start building your tower based on that sort of hard piece of code, so to speak. I mean, that's one use case. I think there are obviously many other use cases that involve kind of using the LLMs as part of the human interface, as providing this, you know, linguistic user interface. We've had, you know, graphical user interfaces. Now we really have a strong kind of linguistic user interface capability, which opens up a bunch of new kinds of ways in which we can make use of computers. And I think some of those very much need a computational backend. The real strength is from having this sort of conversational linguistic interface on the front and sort of hard computation at the back. Some of it is more just about the conversational side of things.
Okay, that's great. Thanks. And there's something very interesting in everything that you said that for me, it's quite interesting, which is you're speaking about a new, when we are dealing with all those systems, and that includes that LLM proxy between the human and Wolfram Alpha, for example, and all other systems, it seems like it involves another way of thinking how to solve our problems. not the traditional way that we have been doing it for a while, because it's iterative, as you mentioned several times. And but there's something you mentioned earlier, which was related to it, the world would be a better place or something like that if we were to reason on a more computational way. And there is a term that Papur created, which was the computational thinking, quite a while ago, and laymen use it a very generic way to mean a lot of different things. But they are trying to talk about the way we develop code and we think about computational problems and develop the code to solve those problems. And so what I wanted to ask is this a new way of thinking that we should incorporate in order to use those tools? Is it being developed this way? That's what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, the computational paradigm, I think, is the core new thing of the 21st century, basically. And it's the thing that it's really the defining sort of intellectual development of the late 20th century, 21st century. You know, what's the history of this? Well, one's interested in kind of formalizing one's way of talking about the world. I'm sure there was a time early in the history of our species where people were just sort of pointing at things. Oh, there's a rock, there's a, you know, there's a squirrel, there's something else. They just point at these different objects. And then somebody had the bright idea, I'm sure it didn't happen right like this, but somebody had the bright idea, we can make up a word, the word rock, that represents any rock, squirrel, that represents any squirrel. And that was sort of the beginning of this formalization of thinking that is human language. And that's been sort of, that was the defining thing that's kind of launched what our species has been able to do. And that same idea of, you know, can you take what is just a vague thing and can you formalize it so you can build on it? That's been done a few other times in history. I mean, logic, for instance, is an example of that. You take kind of the structure of arguments and you say, there's this pattern of the structure of arguments that we can define formally and it's logic, and then we can make deductions from that. And by the way, when people, it's sort of interesting that the LLMs have kind of discovered logic, and I think they've discovered logic in the same way that people like Aristotle discovered logic. That is, they've just looked at a lot of examples of what people have said, and they notice there are certain patterns of what makes a valid argument, so to speak. And they kind of lifted those, and now they're kind of, we can, from the outside, we can say they're doing logic. For the LLM, it's just like, well, I'm just following the same pattern that I've seen in a million different arguments that I've seen on the web, so to speak. But then this idea of formalization, the next really big step in formalization was mathematics. And the idea that we could sort of describe the world mathematically, and that kind of got big in the late 1600s. And that idea is what's kind of propelled most of modern science and engineering, is this kind of notion that we can represent the world mathematically and sort of compute what's going to happen in the world using mathematics. The big thing of that sort of emerged in the 20th century was this idea of computational thinking. What do I mean by that? I mean a way of describing the world using sort of precise representations of things and sort of precise rules for how things operate. And then the process of computation is the process of following those rules and seeing what happens, so to speak. It's a little different from mathematics. Mathematics, you say, I have this whole thing that I've set up and I've defined certain equations, and now I'm going to find a formula for the answer to those equations, the solution to those equations. That's a little different from computation. In computation, you're saying, I'm going to find the rules by which the system operates. And then it's a matter of actually running the computation to see what the system does. And the thing that I think one's seeing happen is that idea of formalizing the world using computation is a thing that allows one to, you know, make models of things that happen in the natural world, in the human world, and so on. It is a way of kind of giving us a way to think about how to structure things. And I mean, I myself have been much involved in kind of bringing that notion into natural science and seeing how one can use programs as a way to describe systems in nature and so on. That's been really successful. It's kind of neat that after 300 years of kind of a dominance of mathematics in describing the natural world, the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, there's been this sort of silent but very complete transition to people using programs as ways to describe sort of what happens in the world. But, you know, what we're seeing happen is this idea of formalizing things using computational language is the a thing that's sort of coming to every different field. So The way I tend to put it is, for every field X, there either is now a computational X or there will be. And computational X will be the way that that field moves forward over the next century or and beyond. I mean, it's kind of a, it's really an important and dramatic thing. I mean, it's kind of a major new framework for thinking about things that we have. And, my own effort has been to try and find a notation for computational thinking, just like mathematical notation, plus signs and equal signs and so on. That's a notation that allows you to talk about mathematics in a streamlined way. So Wolfram Language intends to be a notation for talking about computation in a streamlined way. But there's a big sort of extra piece that you get there, which is as soon as you can talk about computation in a streamlined way, well, computers can actually run the computation for you. So it's not like math, where you can write down the notation, but then you've got to do more work unless you use our technology to do the work for you. But with computation, once you've formulated things in a computational way and you have a computational language that knows enough computationally about the world, then your computer can help you to sort of make progress, so to speak. And I think this is this kind of notion of you can inject computation into things. It's kind of a superpower for every field. And the LLMs are providing a certain, they're helping the interfacing to that power. They're making it easier for a person who, for example, doesn't have that kind of computational way of thinking about things to be able to sort of just talk around it. And the LLM will help focus that into something which can ultimately be formalized in a computational way. I mean, I will say that this whole question of how do you learn to think computationally, it's something which people don't teach very much. It's not the same as teaching how to program. Teaching how to write low-level code is a very, it's very much, well, computers are built this way from an engineering point of view, and they have variables and loops and this and that and the other. And you as a human can learn how to bring yourself down to the level of a computer, so to speak, and see how to do those kinds of things. It's a very different thing to say, can you take the world as we observe it, and can you kind of formalize the things in there to the point where you can sort of describe them precisely yourself, and by the way, have the computer understand these things? I mean, it's been our job to try and define how one talks about the world computationally, and then to have the computer actually be able to do something with that description. But that's kind of the direction that I think it's really a, I mean, these times are really a very important time, I think, in intellectual history. It's kind of the time when this major new idea of computation, computational thinking, and so on really becomes sort of broadly useful and really can accelerate all these different kinds of fields of endeavor and can create a bunch of new ones that we didn't really ever imagine before, that we just didn't have a framework for thinking about those kinds of things.
You have talked about the LLM's capabilities and extensively and how LLMs work and its limitations. I'd be interested in hearing your opinion about whether you believe that LLMs will ever be able to create something new by themselves without human supervision. And here by new, we can be flexible. We can think about things like an invention that could have a patent or art, right? Some sort of art that's not completely copycat of all the things that already exist. Well, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's easy to make original stuff. What's hard is to make original stuff that people care about. In other words, I just pick a sequence of random numbers. I've got something original. That sequence has never been generated before. The question is, does anybody care? And this is where things get interesting, because what LLMs know about is conventional wisdom. They know about what's been out there on the web, what's been done before. Now the question is, to what extent can they come up with things that are new but sufficiently aligned with what's been done before that we care about them? So, for example, let's take the visual example, talking about art. So you can take a generative AI system, and it's been trained based on, pictures on the web and descriptions of those pictures and so on. And you can say, make me a picture of a cat in a party hat. It'll do a reasonable job of that. Okay, but if you look kind of inside the LLM, that thing saying, make me a picture of a cat in a party hat, that turned into a big vector of numbers. that represent the cat and the party hat concept. You can say, let me move those numbers. Let me just change the numbers. I don't know what it's going to mean, but I can just change those numbers. And you'll get a bunch of very different pictures. What you see in that, as you change those numbers, is you'll see what you might call kind of a cat island. There's this region, as you change these numbers, where it recognizably looks like a cat to a human. As you move out of that region, you see things which we don't recognize. They're elaborate patterns. They don't immediately mean anything to us. One way to think about it is, in the space of sort of all possible images, there are ones that we have human concepts for, like cats and dogs and so on. And there's a huge interconcept space of things for which we do not yet have words. Now, maybe some of those things for which we don't have words will be things where somebody says, you know, that's a wonderful kind of art. I'm going to name it such and such, and then everybody's going to care about that kind of art. Or maybe it's just something out there, like the random numbers, in the space of all possibilities, that is something that we humans don't care about. So, you know, this problem of if we've defined an objective, then we can ask the question, you know, can the system sort of satisfy that objective? One of the things that I've done a lot in my life is just search a space of computational possibilities. Say, I need an algorithm to do this. Let me simply search the space of all possible algorithms and try and find one that does the thing I want. And that's surprisingly successful. It's not obvious it would be successful. It's not a trivial fact that it can be successful. The reason that it can be successful is, well, ultimately, it's basically because even very simple programs, it turns out, can do complicated things. But what happens when you do that, when you do these sort of searches in spaces of programs, is you get programs you can hold up and say, this program does this really cool thing. You look at it and you say, I don't understand how this works. Something was found that no engineer would have been able to get to by sort of incrementally tweaking things. But once you have it, it works, and it's something sort of surprising, and it may even be very difficult to analyze why it works. There's a thing I invented, I don't know, 24 years ago now, that is essentially a sort of a mathematical proof type thing where we can see that it's correct. And it's interesting that it's correct, but nobody's understood what the steps. I mean, we can trace each step. We can see what each step is, but nobody can sort of have a narrative for what's going on. So I think the issue is, it's very easy to make original stuff. In the computational universe of possibilities, there's an immense amount of interesting, rich kinds of things, but it's not clear that they align with what we humans care about, either in art or in, you know, to make something that is, you know, if we say we've got this thing that we as a human have defined, this is a problem we're trying to solve, this is an algorithm we want. Yes, you can get kind of, you can search the computational universe and you can find something that will achieve the objective you want. And that's something that actually, I don't think the current round, people have been making a lot of noise about the fact that sort of AIs are discovering sort of ways to make up algorithms that do this and that. It's not really usually, well, it depends what you mean by AI. AI has had a long history going back to 1956 or so, and people have meant different things by AI at different times. If you mean, is it something that's computational, and then the answer is yes, you can find lots of interesting, original, surprising solutions to things that way. If you mean, as it has tended to mean in the last year or two, it's done with neural nets and machine learning and training from existing data, that's not so relevant to these kinds of objectives. I think that the question the thing that an LLM is going to do is, what it is trying to do is, for example, produce text that is typical of what it's seen on the web. So that's not really the same objective as producing something that's a way different, you know, new idea type thing. That's much more the domain of kind of actual sort of raw computation, where you can go out into the computational universe and find things. In fact, one of the interesting things is, people say, you know, what would the AIs do if the AIs were just left to themselves? And one thing the AIs can do is to just go off into this computational universe and start exploring different kinds of things. And, you know, AIs doing that would look to us like, what are the AIs doing? You know, they're sort of playing games that they find amusing for themselves, or that we seem to think that they find amusing for themselves, but we don't know why they're doing those things. And that's really the issue, is how do you get that alignment between what we humans care about and what is sort of computationally possible? I mean, there's an analogy to this in natural science. You know, we look at the natural world and it's doing all these complicated things, most of which we don't care about. We pick out certain particular features of the natural world that we connect to technology, and those are things that we, you know, really pay attention to. But a lot of what happens in the natural world, we just sort of hope nothing happens that blows up in our face and causes us trouble. But mostly it's just doing what it's doing, and we're not, it's not stuff that we care about. I mean, I tend to think that's what's going to happen with AIs in the future, that there's going to be kind of the society of AIs, many, many more AIs than there are humans, that where the AIs are mostly just doing things that are just sort of the things AIs do, just like nature does things that are the things that nature does. We'll observe this from the outside. We may have scientific theories. We may have a natural science, a psychology of AIs, where we say, I know why it's doing that. You know, I have this whole theory of AI psychology that explains that, or whatever else. But it's something which is kind of, we're looking at as outside scientists, so to speak. It's not something where we're going to say, we put the AI up to that. We know, you know, we made a plan where it's exactly going to do these things. I will say that one of the things that, you know, being able to use AIs as tools to sort of create the new, there are many ways they can be used as tools. Whether it's, you know, there's this whole field where there are 10,000 academic papers in this field, and I'm just trying to grind that down to something where I can answer this one question, that's potentially useful. That's kind of an enhanced form of text search and so on. Another thing that's quite interesting is sort of a certain amount of kind of expected creativity. So for example, one thing that I do is making up the obvious names for functions in our computational language. And it's sort of an interesting case because I want the name to be obvious to people. I want it to be, you know, I don't want to be super creative poetic. I want it to be the obvious thing people would think it should be. And LLMs are pretty good at coming up with, here are some obvious possibilities. You know, it's like, I'm usually like, well, that was kind of obvious and I'm not impressed, but it is very useful. Another thing that I think LLMs will be potentially useful for, I haven't actually had this work for me yet, is making analogies. So, you know, one of the things that in areas of science that can be very powerful is to realize, oh, this thing that we've understood in the theory of gravity is the same problem that we have in some area of distributed computing. But as a human, unless you know both of those fields well, and you think in a fairly agile way, it's hard to make that analogy because the words are all different, you know, the details are different, but somehow there's a pattern of how one of these fields works and how the other field works, and they line up. And I think there's a reasonable possibility that LLMs will be helpful in finding those kinds of kind of analogy patterns, which will be, but it will need harnessing by humans. I don't think that's the kind of thing, if it's, you know, left to its own devices, I'm not sure, you know, it'll write some essay. I mean, this is the thing about LLMs, that it's like you're trying to do software quality assurance on LLM output. And you say, how do I know if it's right? You know, well, what does it mean, right? It's producing an essay. Is that essay right? You know, what you realize is a good way to test the essay is to ask the LLM whether it's right. And so you end up with, you know, everything is an essay answer, so to speak. And eventually you can make some cut and say, this essay is so obviously, you know, just say yes or no. And it'll say yes or no. But it's very recursive. Whether it got it right is in the end a matter of sort of LLM judgment, so to speak.
So my last question is, speaking about our podcast, most of our listeners, they are working in software development, in IT, in data science, machine learning, in all these fields, that ranging from people who are still college students to people who are experienced professionals, senior tech leads, and so on. So for them, specifically for the students, but also for people that are further in their careers, what would you recommend that they should learn right now?
Learn computational thinking, and it's not computer science. I mean, learn how to take the things that you might think about in your job, in your life, whatever, and think how to formulate them as it's kind of what kind of computational structure describes what you're talking about. What kind of computational operations do you want to do on that structure? And these are things, you know, that's what I've spent a large part of my life kind of defining this computational language so it's possible to do that, where there is a thing that represents, you know, the country of Brazil or something, and there is a thing that represents kind of the image of the flag of Brazil and the colors that are in it and all those kinds of things. Learning how to take kind of things you might be thinking about in kind of vague terms and see how to formulate those things computationally, that's an incredibly valuable skill. And it's a skill that is not in broad supply, because the way I see it, and it's been sort of a, I have to say, it's a bit of a frustration for me, is that, you know, our tools, Wolfram Language and so on, which we originally introduced, what, 36 years ago now, have been really widely used in kind of the high end of research and development and so on. Incredible number of things, you know, invented, discovered and so on over the years, lots of incredibly famous things that have been built using our tools. But if you look at the typical software engineer, they're probably saying, no, I'm going to write in Java or C++ or Python or something like this. It's like, you know, Wolfram Language, that's this thing for the R&D people. And it's very, you know, it's something that's sort of above my level. Now, you know, it also is the case that a bunch of kids have learned, and, you know, Wolfram Language, you know, the 11-year-olds learn it and have a pretty easy time learning it. And so there's something, you know, what's the disconnect here? And a thing one realizes is this: if you're doing software engineering, a large part of your job is the sort of grinding of writing code. And, you know, in a given, let's say, 2 or 3 week period, most of the time you're just writing lines of code. And then occasionally there's this moment when you have to think, what am I actually building? How am I going to architect? You know, how should I think about this problem in computational terms? But that's a tiny fraction of the time you're spending. Most of the time you're spending is essentially the manual labor of, you know, grinding out the code, so to speak. Now, LLMs help in putting down boilerplate code. My own view of that is much of the time, the, oh my gosh, it wrote, you know, 15 lines of C++ code for me. That's basically telling you those 15 lines of C++ code should have just been defined as a function in your language. And you shouldn't have had to, you know, the fact that the LLM can, yes, you know, spurt out those 15 lines in, you know, I would consider as a language designer that if the LLM is always producing an idiom, it's the same idiom every time, then I failed as a language designer, because if that's an idiom you need all the time, I should have just built that in as something that you can just use off the shelf in the language. But I think the thing to realize is that right now, a typical software engineer is spending a small part of their time kind of architecting and computational thinking, and a large part of their time just writing code. And that, in the sort of high end of the R&D world, that has not been that way for a long, long time. And what happens in sort of the R&D world is people, what they want to do is figure out the thinking about what should be done. And if they can minimize the amount of time they have to spend writing code, that's a huge win. But if your job is being a software engineer, it tends to be the case that the kind of natural thing to do is just spend most of your time writing code. And I think that there's just a, you know, vastly more powerful point you can get to if what you really know about is that sort of computational thinking piece, and then you can automate most of the actual sort of grinding out of code. And, you know, it's been my kind of effort over the years to make it possible for that to be done. And we're definitely at that point, and LLMs help to sort of add, to lubricate that possibility, so to speak. And I think, you know, learn to think about things computationally, learn how to formulate things computationally, emphasize that rather than emphasizing, yes, you know, I should know how to implement a quicksort algorithm in C or something like this. What you should learn about is kind of what kinds of things can you expect algorithms to do? What kinds of things is it worth having, you know, a machine learning classifier try to do? What, you know, understand, get an intuition for how to think about things computationally. And then the details you should be able to delegate to a machine, so to speak. And that's, you know, my life's effort, I suppose, has been to provide that machine to which you can delegate these things. So yeah, long answer to that. But I think, you know, the other thing to realize is the sort of computational X for all X is just a tremendous opportunity. I mean, there are all these things that have been, you know, these fields of human endeavor that have been going for huge amounts of time. And you know, we are at this moment where the computational paradigm can be injected into them, and there are just a huge number of opportunities in along those lines. And we're trying to provide the tools. We also, we've been, you know, providing sort of whatever educational possibilities we can to sort of help people to get to this point of, you know, how do I understand how to think computationally about things? I have to say, having done sort of computational thinking myself for the majority of my life, it's like, I think I know how to do this. And then I decided I'd better explain to other people how to do this. And so I started writing, I wrote a number of years ago, I wrote a book kind of introducing Wolfram Language, but I'm trying now to write something more generally about how to think about the world computationally. And it's interesting. It's kind of difficult because this hasn't been verbalized before. You can't get a textbook on that. That means I get the responsibility to try to write that textbook, which I'm slowly trying to do. And hopefully that will provide. But I think I want to say that one feature of how do you learn to think computationally, one thing about it is there's just a lot of different parts of the world that you can think about computationally, whether it's about geographic computation, whether it's about bioinformatic computation, whether it's about these different kinds of things. And a large part of kind of teaching people about computational thinking is actually knowing the facts of all these different areas. They are the kind of anchors that you use to kind of fill out computational thinking. So it's not like there's a magic abstract thing to say. It's rather there's a lot of kind of factual knowledge that across all these different areas, which fits together through this kind of computational paradigm.
Mr. Wolfram, to finish off, and still on the subject of computational thinking, from backspace keystroke to a full body MRI, you have one of the most interesting approaches to collecting data about yourself that we've all ever heard, right? So from how you intended to use this data back when you started collecting it, presumably to explore through Wolfram Language, to now that you can add ChatGPT or other LLMs to the mix, what sort of use have you been putting to this data for your own personal benefit? And how is the work on the Stephen Wolfram bot so that all our listeners can someday interview you and get advices from you as well?
Right. You know, I started, 30 years ago or more, kind of trying to record as much data as possible because it was easy to do and because I didn't want to lose stuff. And the number one use that I put to all the data that I record is to enhance my memory. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have a pretty good human memory, and that spoils me because now I really want to remember everything. And I have pretty much that capability by recording all of this data. Occasionally, I'll wonder about some question about myself and I'll, you know, grind the data and I'll say, oh, okay, I can conclude that I am not, sleeping more when there are all sorts of strange things about myself. Like when I have an intense project that I'm working on, you know, I know that I lose weight when I have an intense project. That's one interesting factoid that you can tell from, you know, more keystrokes, less weight, so to speak. those are kind of silly things in a sense, but although useful at times when you wonder, oh, you know, is this issue, this, you have this question or that question, and it's kind of easy to grind the data and find out the answer. In terms of a bot of myself, you know, I have long wondered, at what point will I have recorded so much about myself that, you know, you could just reconstruct everything useful about my brain just from the things that are externally recorded. I don't know when that will happen. I think there's about 50 million words of things I've written or said that I have that are out there. And, you know, is that enough? Is 50 million words enough to reconstruct sort of my neural net, so to speak? I don't think it's far off. There's certainly somebody's done a little experiment making a Steven bot that I haven't interacted with that much. So I can't personally comment on how convincing it is to me, which may be different for how convincing it is to other people. It may be very convincing to other people, not so convincing to me. It does, as you start thinking about those kinds of capabilities, I have to say, I start wondering if there was a good bot of myself, would I like the good bot of myself? How would I interact? You know, my life is about, you know, trying to make projects happen, running a company, you know, which is trying to take sort of ideas I have and turn them into real things. And it's like, if I had, you know, a bunch of kind of bot lieutenants who were exactly like me, would that be a huge win? I think it would be a huge win, but maybe I have too positive a view of myself. I don't know. I mean, but it's really a, It's an interesting, you know, I think one of the things we're seeing with LLMs right now is a bunch of research in the group dynamics of LLMs. I mean, it's been hard enough to have one LLM, but now the question is, if you put 10 LLMs in a room together, you know, 10 bots of me in a room together, what happens? We don't know yet. I'm curious. Hopefully we'll be able to do that simulation. You know, we don't get to do that in real life, but we hopefully we can do that simulation. And maybe maybe I'll learn a bunch about myself, if nothing else, by watching that simulation play out.
You can sure put us all in the list of the hopefuls as well. Mr. Wolfram, thank you very much for your time, for this talk. I'm sure folks are going to love it. If the listeners and the students want to keep following your work or the work of the Wolfram Research, where should they go? How should they do that?
Look at my posts on X, look at my writings website, go to wolfram.com, our corporate site, stephenwolfram.com. These are all good things. Another thing I might say is about twice a week, I do a live stream where I try and answer questions and so on from people. And that's another place to connect.
Links will be in the description. Thank you very much once again. It has been a huge honor. E para você que curtiu, espero que assim como nós, esse papo com o Stephen Wolfram, não faltam oportunidades e possibilidades para você mergulhar no mundo da IA, tanto na Alura, quanto também na imersão IA, junto com o Google, que o Fabrício fez e que, por sinal, se você não se inscreveu ainda, pausa o episódio, se inscreve e dá play para ouvir o Fabrício falar sobre ela.
É exato, lá em alura.com.br/imersão-IA, o link também, como sempre, vai estar aqui na descrição desse episódio, mas vai ser muito bacana, a gente gravou com o Paulo Silveira, que é CEO da Alura, comigo lá, como um dos especialistas, também o Luciano Martins, que ele é DevRel de Cloud AI, lá no próprio Google, e a Ana Raquel, a professora Ana Raquel, que é cientista de dados na FIAP, a nossa universidade aqui do grupo. Nós quatro gravamos essa imersão e tem muita coisa, desde para quem não sabe de nada, então você pode mandar para o seu irmão, para sua irmã, para seu primo, para sobrinha, para sua mãe. Então as primeiras aulas vão começar para quem não sabe de nada, a gente vai explicar bem a base mesmo da IA. Depois a gente já vai explicar os conceitos e mostrar na prática, ensinar os principais conceitos e técnicas de engenharia de prompt, que é uma habilidade que vai ser muito útil para todo mundo que usa modelos de IA desde agora até o futuro, né? A IA vai estar em todas as carreiras e você sabendo essas técnicas, você vai poder aplicar melhor para facilitar o seu dia a dia. E aí no final a gente vai até criar um chatbot juntos, mesmo para quem não sabe programação, a gente vai ali segurar a sua mão, então vai ter um aulão de Python na live intermediária, né, ensinando a base do Python, para depois a gente poder aplicar nas últimas duas aulas, onde a gente vai tanto criar um chatbot, você vai criar um chatbot junto com a gente, usando o Gemini, que é o modelo de IA do Google, e na última aula a gente já vai fazer uma coisa mais com o RAG, né? Então como você conectar o poder do Gemini com documentos que você tenha internos aí na sua empresa, por exemplo, né? Então, você vai alimentar ele com documentos, com dados que sejam específicos para você, ou para o seu caso, ou para a sua empresa, e aí ele vai conseguir tanto mergulhar, né, pegar o conhecimento desses dados, mas se juntar também com o poder do LLM. Vai ficar muito, muito boa essa imersão. E lembrando, são 5 aulas gratuitas. Então, não tem desculpa, se inscreve lá. E o melhor disso, Marcos, é que essa imersão vai ter prêmios. Os 10 melhores projetos, a gente vai ter um projetinho lá no meio que a gente só vai anunciar o enunciado desse projeto lá no meio da imersão. E o prêmio número 1 vai ganhar uma bolsa de 100% para estudar na FIAP. Também vai ganhar o plano da Alura Pro, então vai poder ser aluno nosso gratuitamente. Vai ganhar um ingresso para a IA Conference Brasil, que a gente está fazendo, a Alura está fazendo aqui em São Paulo. Vai ser no dia 21 de agosto. Se você quiser saber mais, o link também está aqui na descrição para você entrar na lista de espera. E vai ganhar uma visita no escritório do Google em São Paulo, vai conhecer o Luciano Martins, né, que foi um dos instrutores da imersão, e tem muito mais prêmios, né? Esse aqui que eu estou falando é o prêmio para o primeiro colocado, mas vai ter prêmios do primeiro até o 10º colocado dos melhores projetos. Então vai lá, se inscreve, que você, além de aprender sobre inteligência artificial, aprender como utilizar ela na sua carreira, criar um portfólio, criar um chatbot, e você também vai poder concorrer a esses prêmios maravilhosos.
Maravilha. Cá entre nós, espero que seja um ouvinte do Hipsters Fora de Controle que vença isso aí. Então vão lá, se inscrevam. Estou bem animado para ver no ar essa imersão, o resultado disso também. Obrigado pela audiência de vocês. Lembrando que se vocês quiserem conhecer outros podcasts aqui do grupo, você pode passar na descrição, pegar o link para ver os podcasts da FIAP, da PM3 também, que fazem parte aqui do grupo da Hipsters Network. E na semana que vem a gente está de volta. Obrigado pela audiência de vocês. Hipsters, abraços, tchau.
Este podcast foi produzido pela Alura. Mergulhe em tecnologia. E Faculdade FIAP. Let's Rock the Future. Edição Rede Gigahertz de Podcasts.